Hello, folks, and welcome to another edition of the Dr. Mark Foster Show. Today I will wrap up, I think, at least for now, my discussion of the tablet, The Seven Valleys, or Haftvedi, by Baha'u'llah, by providing a somewhat personal perspective. I offer this with some degree of hesitation, and let me tell you why at the outset. I don't want this to appear as though I am exalting myself at all. To the contrary, I feel very, very lowly. I have a very strong sense of my own personal inadequacy. I realize that throughout most of my life, my spirituality was extraordinarily limited, that what I thought was spirituality was really more intellectualism. It is only in the last, maybe 6 years or so, maybe seven, that as a result of having had a spiritual experience, which I will talk about in just a bit, that I have been able to move beyond that plane of intellectualism. So this really is a celebration of God's bounty on me, a worthless, lowly piece of dirt who has gone through his life as a feeble autistic with virtually no sense of love for anybody, a very common experience among autistics, someone who really had an inability to experience compassion for anyone. I used to always say to myself, and sometimes in my blunter moments to others, that I have never really loved anyone. I did not experience love for my parents, for my sister, for anyone I knew. I did have certain levels of attachment to various people, including my dear spiritual mother, the late Elizabeth Thomas. But love, not really. Not really. Empathy, certainly not. If you know anything about autism, you know that one of the major impairments that people with autism spectrum disorder experience is a lack of what is commonly called theory of mind. The term theory of mind does not mean theory in the usual academic sense of scientific explanation. It refers to an inability to reach out and look at things from the perspective of other people, and sometimes also an inability to even look at things from a personal perspective, where one really has an insight into who one is, into one's own self-concept. In my case, it was primarily a lack of ability to love, to empathize, to have any sense of affection for anyone, and consequently, I clung to things, to objects. As a child, it was my various collections of things, including my collection of ventriloquist dummies, my collections of books, which have continued to the present time, my collections of materials related to the late President Jack Kennedy, and many other things as well. So lacking an ability to feel any sense of identity with other people, my identity came primarily from inanimate objects. Then, about 6 or 7 years ago, I began a practice of meditation. It was at around that time that I developed an interest in tasawuf, which is Sufism. And I began to develop a resource, which I still maintain to some extent, called Sufi Information Central. And I thought, well, since I am studying Sufism and trying to collect what became the largest Sufi resource on the web, maybe I should try to practice a kind of Sufi meditation technique for myself. I had in the past tried other meditation techniques with no effect at all. I was always deeply disappointed in the inability of meditation to have any enduring impact on me. I recall a letter written on behalf of Shoghi Effendi, where he said that the friends, the Baha'is, can be taught to meditate, but they should guard against any superstitious or foolish ideas creeping into it. And I tried to do that, but even still, my attempts at meditation and getting in touch with the deeper aspects of my spiritual being were a failure. And so I remained on a very cerebral plane without any access to anything else. Then, as I say, about 6-7 years ago, when I practiced this kind of Sufi meditation, which I got from a Naqshbandi Sufi site, and the word Naqshbandi is Persian. Naqsh is heart. Bond is a cognate with the English language words bond and band. So literally, Naqshbandi is to bond or to band one's heart to God. The common Naqshbandi approach to meditation or zikr, zikr is remembrance, is a kind of silent repetition of words. What they are can vary. It can be Allahu, Allahu, Allahu. That's fairly common. But there are a lot of other variations and a lot of other words that people say in their zikr. I tried various things, but what I noticed was that all of a sudden, in the course of engaging in this practice, that I experienced tremendous exhilaration. Now, I had felt spiritual happiness before, but not to the extent that I did at that time. It was really, really strong. And I felt transported to some higher level. I began also to feel a deep spiritual connection with a long-departed Punjabi Sufi named Hazrat Sultan Bahu. Bahu is a Persian Arabic word hybrid. Ba is the Persian word for with. Hu is the Arabic word for he. Bahu, which was the name that was given to him by his mother, Bibi Rasti, Madam Truth, was a very important part of who he was, and Sultan Bahu very deeply identified with his name and really wanted to be with he, with God. And what Bahu said is that a person did not need, in his view, to be a member of a Sufi order or even to follow a living Sufi teacher, Sheikh, a peer. That instead, a person could simply turn to God or turn to the spirit of Bahu and read Bahu's books, and that he would guide the seeker to a kind of spiritual reunion. Well, that was my experience. I felt that kind of connection. And Bahu was not Naqshbandi. Bahu was Qadri, or in Arabic, Qadriya, which is a different Sufi order. But he is the person that I felt most connected to. In fact, I came to view Sultan Bahu as my guardian angel. And still, I view him in that way. Because I felt my first connection, really deep connection to God through Bahu. I have sometimes said that Bahu led me to Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, on a deeper spiritual level. So I think that really it was at that point that I really entered the valley of search. I became a seeker at that point. I had that deep sense of search. Baha'u'llah wrote in the Valley of Search, "It is incumbent on these servants that they cleanse the heart, which is the wellspring of divine treasures, from every marking, and that they turn away from imitation, which is following the traces of their forefathers and sires, and shut the door of friendliness and enmity upon all the people of the earth." In other words, to eliminate attachment, to be detached. Because if one experiences attachment to anything in this world of dust, then one's search will be biased. One will not see things, as Baha'u'llah says in the Hidden Words, with his own eyes. In other words, one will not have a sense of personal justice. And that is what I experienced, that suddenly nothing really mattered to me except a sense of searching for God, becoming united with God. And it was through that experience that, as as Baha'u'llah wrote in the Seven Valleys, and if by the help of God he findeth on this journey a trace of the traceless friend, and inhaleth the fragrance of the long lost Joseph from the heavenly messenger, he shall straightway step into the valley of love and be dissolved in the fire of love. In this city, the heaven of ecstasy is upraised, and the world illumining sun of yearning shineth, and the fire of love is ablaze. And when the fire of love is ablaze, it burneth to ashes the harvest of reason. There is, therefore, in a sense, a kind of spiritual insanity or spiritual intoxication that accompanies the person who experiences this journey into the valley of love. And it was through this process of search that I felt love for the first time, and that love was for Sultan Bahu. And again, through Sultan Bahu, for Baha'u'llah, Abdul Baha, the Bab, the beloved Saint Paul, the exalted Muhammad, the wonderful Bab, all the great prophets and messengers, I felt a sense of connectedness with them. For some reason, especially with Paul. And I think that was because I came to see that Paul was the heart of the Christian dispensation of the revelation of Christ. He was the mirror, I think, of Christ, the dependent prophet of Christ, that really without understanding and loving Paul, it is very difficult to understand and love Christ, and to understand his message that the spirit of tolerance and diversity and adaptability comes from Paul. Paul was all things to all people. He would present the gospel of Christ in a manner which corresponded to the needs of the person that he was addressing or the congregation that he was addressing. So he would say some things to the Ephesians and other things to the Corinthians and so on. He treated people according to their capacity and according to their level of development. From love, one moves into the valley of knowledge. Baha'u'llah wrote, and if, confirmed by the Creator, the lover escapes from the claws of the eagle of love, he will enter the valley of knowledge and come out of doubt into certitude, and turn from the darkness of illusion to the guiding light of the fear of God. His inner eyes will open, and he will privily converse with his beloved. He will set ajar the gate of truth and piety, and shut the doors of vain imaginings. He in this station is content with the decree of God, and seeth war as peace, and findeth in death the secrets of everlasting life, With inward and outward eyes he witnesseth the mysteries of resurrection in the realms of creation and the souls of men, and with a pure heart apprehendeth the divine wisdom in the endless manifestations of God. In the ocean he findeth a drop. In a drop he beholdeth the secrets of the sea. What I realized is that true knowledge comes out of love. So knowledge is a natural development out of love. What I thought was knowledge before was not knowledge, it was intellectualism. Knowledge is the awakening of the eyes of the heart as a result of the fire of love. When the fire of love has burned away all attachment to the world, then one achieves a knowledge of the beloved, and one can distinguish, at least to some extent, imagination from revelation. Obviously, not perfectly, but to some extent. And that is what I was able to experience in my own life. Pardon me. Now, at the end of the Valley of Knowledge, Baha'u'llah says, after passing through the Valley of Knowledge, which is the last plane of limitation, the wayfarer cometh to the Valley of Unity and drinketh from the cup of the Absolute and gazeth on the manifestations of oneness. The last plane of limitation. Well, unity is without limitation. Unity is in the Arabic Tawheed, and Baha'u'llah uses the word Tawheed here, in even though it is a Persian tablet, he uses a lot of Arabic words, and literally the word Tawheed translates as unification or unifying, because I think God is the unification of all things, the innermost unity around which all other things are unified, the spirit of unity that all the other unities, the other waheds or unities, ones, emanate and manifest from. And so when one is in a person, in a station rather, of unity, one is no longer limited, because unity has no limitations. Search is limited by the capacity of the seeker. Love is limited, again, by the capacity of the seeker. And knowledge is limited by the capacity of the seeker. But unity is the essence of all things, and is manifested and emanated in all things, is expressed in all things. So there is no limitation in unity. So it is through having gone through the first three valleys that one comes into this plane of unity. And I can tell you, in my own life, at around the time when I think I began to perhaps experience some inkling of this valley, I changed the name of one of my websites to Unities of All Things, when it occurred to me that the way in which the way in which existence is organized can, at least in one sense, from one perspective, be approached according to the Baha'i calendar, the Badzi or the wonderful calendar that was originally developed by the Bab and then revised by Baha'u'llah. And in this calendar, there are 19 within 19 within 19. 19 is one. Unity. Wahid is one. But the value of the word, the numerical or abjad value of the word Wahid is 19. So I think that there are dimensions of 19 within dimensions of 19. And I explore this in my own understanding of what these planes are and how they work within my book, The Unicentric Paradigm, where I get into, in some depth, I think, the nature of unity and how unity is manifested in all things. Now, after having gone through unity, then the next valley is the valley of contentment. Baha'u'llah wrote, "And the wayfarer, after traversing the high plains of this supernal journey, entereth the valley of contentment. In this valley he feeleth the winds of divine contentment blowing from the plane of the spirit. He burneth away the veils of want, and with inward and outward eye perceiveth within and without all things the day of God will compensate each one out of his abundance. From sorrow he turneth to bliss, from anguish to joy. His grief and mourning yield to delight and rapture. Although to outward view the wayfarers of this valley may dwell upon the dust, yet inwardly they are enthroned in the heights of mystic meaning. They eat of the endless bounties of inner significances and drink of the delicate wines of the spirit. The tongue faileth in describing these three valleys, and speech falleth short. The pen steppeth not into this region. The ink leaveth only a blot. In these plains, the nightingale of the heart hath other songs and secrets, which make the heart to stir and the soul to clamor. But this mystery of inner meaning may be whispered only from heart to heart, confided only from breast to breast. Once a soul, my own words now, has passed through and entered into the planes of non-limitation, beginning with unity and now contentment, the soul is in a state of relaxation and assurance and certitude. The only source of contentment is unity. So contentment naturally flows from unity. I can say that in my own life, after having worked on the book The Unicentric Paradigm, after I changed the title of that site to Unities of All Things, I began to feel waves of contentment sweeping me up. I just felt at peace, knowing that there was nothing to worry about, that all things were in God's hands, and that whatever happens to me is irrelevant, because I'm nothing. Who cares? There are countless worlds of God, with beings, with souls, in each of them. So, what difference do I make? In fact, I make no difference at all. That is contentment. Contentment with adversity, or with anything that God may choose to give the human soul, it doesn't matter, because all comes from God, and we all come from God, and we are in the process, if we choose, of returning to Him. Baha'u'llah continues, "After journeying through the plains of pure contentment, the traveler cometh to the valley of wonderment and is tossed in the oceans of grandeur, and at every moment his wonder groweth. Now he seeth the shape of wealth as poverty itself, and the essence of freedom as sheer impotence. Now is he struck dumb with the beauty of the All-Glorious. Again is he wearied out with his own life." Then further into that valley, Baha'u'llah continues, "Indeed, O brother, if we ponder each created thing, we shall witness a myriad perfect wisdoms and learn a myriad new and wondrous truths. One of the created phenomena is the dream. Behold how many secrets are deposited therein, how many wisdoms treasured up, how many worlds concealed. Observe how thou art asleep in a dwelling, and its doors are barred. On a sudden, thou findest thyself in a far-off city, which thou enterest without moving thy feet or wearying thy body. Without using thine eyes, thou seest. Without taxing thine ears, thou hearest. Without a tongue, thou speakest. And perchance, when 10 years are gone, thou wilt witness in the outer world the very things thou hast dreamed tonight. Now, there are many wisdoms to ponder in the dream, which none but the people of this valley can comprehend in their true elements. First, what is this world where without eye and ear and hand and tongue a man puts all of these to use? Second, how is it that in the outer world thou seest today the effect of a dream when thou didst vision it in the world of sleep some 10 years past? Consider the difference between these two worlds and the mysteries which they conceal, that thou mayest attain to divine confirmations and heavenly discoveries, and enter the regions of holiness. That's the end of the quotation. Elsewhere, Baha'u'llah talks about dreams as contained within ourselves and as the innermost reality of this world, and refers to the beings which inhabit this world that we experience in our dreams. What I have come to understand personally, from my own personal reflections, is that this world of dreams is our taste of the realm of archangels, that we are living in this world of archangels here. This world is their world. When we are awake, when our senses are active, we can't see it. Instead, we see the shell, the outward form or outward appearance of the archangelic world, of this world. But it's not real. It is, to use the Sanskrit term maya, illusion. If we get wrapped up in this world, and we think that this world, for us, is our home, then we are deluded. People who have no awareness of what this world is, that this world is a temporary way station on our journey toward the next world, toward the Abha Kingdom, the most glorious kingdom, which is our home, then whatever happens to us here simply doesn't matter. These archangels which inhabit this world, which we see when our senses are dimmed at night, are, as described in the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, Jacob's ladder. They are the connecting point between us in the world of dust, in this outer shell of the archangelic world, and the realms beyond, the Abha Kingdom. In many of my dreams, I will meet my spiritual mother, Elizabeth Thomas. Recently, I had a very vivid dream of her, and in that dream, there was also an angel named Emily. At least that's the name she gave me. She was there the whole time that I was sitting and conversing with Elizabeth. So I think that these archangels, these beings, this is where they are from. They are neither born nor die. They are from here. But they can move back and forth. They can come here, they can manifest here, perhaps even physically in a sense, at least visibly. And they can also ascend into the higher kingdoms. And they can serve souls in both conditions. They can serve souls here, and they can serve souls in the world to come. When Jesus was here, it was said that he was made a little lower than the angels. Of course, that was a temporary condition. When he was in this shell of the world of archangels, he was briefly in a position of subordinates to the archangelic world, Then, of course, after death, he ascended back to his rightful place in the highest realms of the spiritual kingdom, in the manifested planes of the spiritual kingdom, or the greater world. So I think that for that reason, although life in this world is important, if we make the right choices, it's not necessary. All of the fuss that people make today about the abortion issue is a total waste of time, in my view. In fact, in the Tanakh, I believe the book of Leviticus, although I don't have the reference right in front of me, there is a list of different laws or punishments for various offenses. First, it says that for murder, the punishment is death. Then it says for killing the fetus of a woman, the punishment is paying a fine. Well, if that were murder, as many people claim, why would the punishment also not be death? And I think that is because the fetus is a developing vehicle which will serve as the outer form of the soul in this world, but it is not yet a person. A majority of fertilized eggs of zygotes do not attach themselves to the uterine wall. And if we believe that the soul comes into existence at the moment of conception, that means that simply by nature, most created souls do not come to this world. So, although I'm certainly not suggesting that abortion should be done for no reason, to make such a big deal out of it is, I think, a bit unnecessary. That's something that at least is my own perspective on it. Take it for what you will. Finally, the valley of true poverty and absolute nothingness. The term absolute nothingness is a translation of the Arabic word fana, which is annihilation, extinction. So it's the valley of true poverty and extinction, the extinction of the self. But Marzia Gale, in translating it as absolute nothingness, I think was very wise. Because in this station, one recognizes that one really is absolutely nothing. This is the reality of martyrdom. That is the station. This station, in my view, is the station of martyrdom. If we can live in this world of true poverty, being poor to all things save God, and absolute nothingness, or the annihilation of the lower self, then we are, in a sense, martyrs. That does not mean that we need to necessarily sacrifice our physical lives, unless that is required of us. But being in this condition of martyrdom does not necessarily mean that a person has to be physically martyred. Martyrdom can be living a life of service as well. But once the soul is living in this plane of true poverty and absolute nothingness, then, since a person recognizes that this world really does not matter that much, that it is just this outward shell of the world of archangels, so it naturally flows from the valley of wonderment, then who cares Who cares? Who cares when I die? That's something that I've experienced lately. I literally don't care about when I die. I don't have a death wish in the sense people use that term. I appreciate this world, but I also look forward to the next one very anxiously. I think of all the souls that I have known in this world who have now passed on, especially my spiritual mother, and how much I would like to spend more time with her, fully conscious. And I think of other people that I have never met, that I would like to meet, and I realize that I will have all of eternity to have the bounty, God willing, of meeting them as well. So whether one meets people in this world or doesn't meet people in this world or does this or does that, it's all irrelevant. The ultimate fruit of this world is martyrdom. It's the death of the self and the realization that this life doesn't matter. So I think that is the progress of the soul through the seven valleys, at least my own experience. And again, I've tried to present it in a way that is not intended to make myself look like I'm anything, because I know I'm not. I know I'm not. I know I'm not. I'm nothing. I've always been nothing. I realize that more now than ever. I have a complete sense of personal inadequacy and nothingness, and I just don't care. So hopefully my thoughts have been helpful to some other people, my reflections. Please don't take them with any degree of authority, because they have no authority. They're just my own musings. But if some people can perhaps use these ideas in their own reflections and get some benefit from it, then that will be good, and that will have accomplished my intention. Until next time, this is Dr. Mark Foster. Have a good one.